This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Succession. For your awards consideration, Succession, the HBO original drama praised by Vulture as the best show on TV, hailed by the Chicago Sun-Times for being wickedly funny and wildly entertaining, don't miss what IndieWire calls fall TV's must-see event. Succession is now streaming on HBO Max. Welcome to The Playlist Podcast, a weekly discussion of films and TV. I'm your host, Charles Barfield, managing editor of The Playlist. And joining me for this discussion, I have one of my regular co-hosts, Mike D'Angelo, and editor-in-chief of The Playlist, Rodrigo Perez. Are you guys ready to talk about the greatest love story ever told?
Yes!
Actually, I should amend that because I'm reminded now when I say that, that Vin Diesel said that the greatest love story ever told was in Fast and Furious between him and Letty. So...
yeah, you're probably right.
Or him and Paul Walker is probably a better...
Pablo.
Yeah.
All right. Enough of that. We'll save that for our Fast and Furious breakdown. It's been nearly 20 years since we last saw Neo, Trinity, Morpheus, and the rest of the Matrix folks. But they're back for the latest Matrix movie titled The Matrix Resurrections. This time, instead of both Wachowskis, we're just getting Lana. But Keanu Reeves and Carrie Ann Moss are back to show us why this whole franchise is really all about love. We're going to dive deep into The Matrix Resurrections in this podcast. We're going to give our thoughts about the film. And much like our last discussion about Spider-Man No Way Home, this should be a lively one. And I think we're all on the same sides. Well, no, I mean, similar sides, I should say. We've got one curmudgeon in the group.
Yeah.
I'll let you guys guess who that is.
Which is standard.
Yep. And as we always do for this type of movie, we're going to begin the discussion with some strictly non-spoiler talk, where we go over our general thoughts on the film and whether or not we recommend it. Then after that, I'll warn you before we move into the spoiler part. But before we dive into the Matrix sequel, I got to tell you the Playlist Podcast is part of the Playlist Podcast Network, which includes Be Real, The Fourth Wall, Deep Focus, The Discourse, and more. And if you want to find us...
Yellow Stoners.
And if you want to find us, you can check your podcast app of choice, whether that's Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Spotify, Anchor, Stitcher, anywhere else you find your favorite shows. Okay, gentlemen. Right off the bat, I got to say, like Spider-Man, talking about The Matrix Resurrections in a non-spoiler situation is going to be tough. But that said, I want to know your overall thoughts about Resurrections. So, Mike, why don't you start us off?
Yeah, happy to. As a fan of The Matrix and its original sequels, for me, I think I can confidently say that it's the best of the sequels for me. And for people who are fans of the whole series. But your enjoyment of the film kind of depends on how much you enjoy the sequels and their tendency to get a bit up their own ass with the amount of ideas they present and how much you enjoy movies and TV series that really lean into the meta of it all. And that's because this movie really leans into the meta. And there's so much of that there's a whole new kind of comedic element that hasn't really been present in any of the films. And some of it I found really charming. Some of it I was like, okay, enough, guys. But I really like a lot of things about the movie. I like that it's a commentary on humanity over the last 20 years about nostalgic consumerism that we've been having a lot of chats about Spider-Man and the false narratives that are fed to people like us, those us versus them, real versus fake, Matrix versus Spider-Man, sequels versus reboots, you know, the Matrix versus its own sequels, and the idea that in the end, like you were kind of alluding to, it's not about opposing forces slamming against each other that's going to help humanity. It's about connection and love. And I really like that she kind of threw in that tribute to her parents wrapped into this movie, and also found a way to deconstruct the Matrix within all of it. And I still haven't even touched all the ideas that this film presents. So I just really appreciate that Lana Wachowski took the trappings of her own creation, which had become a bit of a prison to her, you know, and created an interesting meta action love story out of it that for me largely works, mostly due obviously to the insane chemistry between Keanu Reeves and Carrie Ann Moss. but you know, it reframes characters and scenarios from the first films and presents them and introduces new faces that, you know, knock their parts out of the water. Specifically Jessica Henwick, her Bugs character, Jonathan Groff. I won't say his name. Yahya Abdul-Mateen's Morpheus, really big fan of what he did, especially being like painted into a corner with his role. And I have a feeling that it's going to be a really rewarding rewatch too, because there's so much going on. So I look forward to watching it again. And on really HBO the only Max. Thing, yes, on HBO Max. hey, so they got to get those streaming numbers from someone, and I'll definitely give them a few. But the only thing I can really slight against it is The Matrix itself, the first film, was such a groundbreaking action film, and the action was just game-changing for blockbusters. Like, everybody tried to copy them or one-up them or do something similar to The Matrix after it came out. And this one, the action was fine. It was good, but it wasn't Matrix level, you know? So it kind of had itself to compete with there. But even so, I thought it was a really entertaining, interestingly thought out sequel.
You know, that made me think of something my wife said, actually, after I told her I saw this movie and I was like really excited about it. she goes, she hasn't seen the sequels. She only watched the first Matrix probably 20 years ago. And she, the first thing she said was, are they still wearing those silly leather costumes? And I was like, oh boy, this movie is not for you. Speaking of movie not for you, Rodrigo, what were your thoughts on The Matrix Resurrections?
I think, isn't it PVC?
Oh, you're correcting my my use of leather. Yeah, leather. I would imagine that some of it is actual PVC.
I don't think it's actually leather. I think it's more like, PVC, right?
You know, I guess. I don't know. I'm not really into the culture, so I don't know.
Whatever, dude. I've seen you in shiny black outfits.
Well, technically, I do wear black pretty much every day. It's just not PVC. Anyway, we're getting way into what are we talking about here? Rodrigo, shit on The Matrix, please.
I don't know if I need to, or not even need to, want to, or it's like, we just talked Spider-Man and you know, my feelings aren't as strong. And at the same level, I think it's, first of all, I thought everything Mike said was really interesting. And I was like, I wish I could have seen that version of the movie, because that was actually quite thoughtful. And I was like, I think what's cool is that, like, the one thing it's interesting, I think, to the outside person, I think everybody can agree. Everybody agree. Like, it seems like Mike's there. I'm sure you're there, Charles. Regardless whether you like this movie or not, I think everybody can agree that it's like super meta and meta beyond probably anything we've ever seen in a franchise movie, if not most mainstream movies.
It's Rick and Morty level.
Yeah.
So I think maybe that's the, because some people really hate the meta part aspect of it, and certain people really, I think even people who really like it, some people just go like, it's not my favorite, but I look past it. And I've heard a lot of that kind of thing. Like, it didn't bother me so much. I get that it's a little bit dumb, but I'm okay with that because of this and that. I do.
He is good in the movie.
What's that?
You were like, It's like, he is good in the movie.
Anyway. I think the love story part of it is actually kind of interesting. I actually think, well, the action is a funny interest is an interesting thing to bring up, because the action is not so great in terms of compared to Matrix movies.
Yeah.
The action coordinator, a choreographer, I'm going to butcher his name, but I believe it's Young Ping from the original ones. He was like the action choreographer of the original ones, and he's not involved in these ones. I think that might have been due because of COVID and things like that. So like, the action does pale in comparison to the original in terms of the way it's shot and the way it's choreographed and all that. But the action in the last act of the movie is so fun and so over the top and so ridiculous that that's where I just started to be like, oh, I'm kind of enjoying this. This is kind of just kind of fun and dumb. And I guess maybe my best way to put it is that, like, I always say that, like, turn off your brain and just enjoy the film is one of the most kind of condescending and asinine ways to see a movie.
And this isn't that kind of movie, man.
No, but to me, like for me to finally enjoy it, I actually had to kind of go there. Like by the end, I was like, all right, this is just so silly. None of it makes a lick of fucking sense. It's beyond nonsensical in a way, way beyond what the original, like I'm totally on board with the original Matrix trilogy. And I mean, I don't think the second and third ones are as good, but I think everyone agrees about that. And I think I, you know, as much as I don't think those second and third films are all that great. I think the trilogy itself is still like, I buy into all the ideas. It's fine. This sort of just like, it's like, what? It just becomes, it's so exposition heavy. It's so, the entire film is almost an excuse for its own existence in through exposition, which is a really hard road to get past if you're sensitive to exposition and sensitive to like a movie that's like needs to explain itself and justify its existence while it's also trying to critique sequels while being a sequel. Like there's a lot of, I gotta say, some of the takes that I've seen that people are being like, yeah, Matrix 4 is like it's giving two fingers to sequels and all that kind of stuff. I'm like, this is the fourth Matrix, asshole. Like, are you fucking like, are you that clueless about what you just said? Are you that unself-aware? So yes, it's critiquing sequels and sequel culture and all that stuff, but it is that. So you can't kind of have your cake and eat it too. And it tries to. So, you know, a very clunky, silly, difficult lead up to me. And then somewhere maybe in the second half, third half, I just kind of was like, all right, whatever. Let's just kind of like, there's no point in trying to understand what this is trying to be. Let's just enjoy it for what it is. And the action and love crescendo is pretty fun. So I don't think it's all that great. But I think I find myself just being like, all right, let's just fucking enjoy what we can. And like some of the action in that last act, while not of on par with Matrix, is still pretty badass and fun.
Yeah. So I think you bring up a good point, Rodrigo. A lot of what you're saying, I think, kind of gels with what I'm thinking too, except I am much more positive about the overall movie because the way I see it, which I think is interesting, is that this kind of, in my mind, boils down to having just Lana Wachowski and not Lily Wachowski. Mm-hmm. This is the first major movie, I think the first movie they've done separately. I know Lily's working on her TV show on Showtime. But what I noticed, and I think I mentioned this to you, Mike, as we were leaving the screening, this is really silly, borderline dumb in places, but like gloriously dumb, like kind of doesn't give a shit dumb. And I was there for it. But I think what it is I think it's without Lily, Lana's clearly the chemistry, fun, you know, storytelling half of that duo. Whereas I think the stuff that's missing might be, you know, that self-serious world building, high philosophical discussion, pontification, that sort of thing, which may be what Lily brought to the franchise.
I mean, so, there's still a lot of high philosophical discussion.
Right. But it felt like it was the watered down version of that. Right. So one of the things that without getting into spoilers, I think Rodrigo talks about the exposition here. What we got in Matrix Reloaded, when I think of exposition dumps of exposition dumps, it's that architect scene. Right. Yeah. Where it's literally two guys in a room surrounded by TVs, just talking back and forth about these high philosophical questions. Okay. And in this, we get similar scenes, but they're a bit quicker. They're a bit less wordy in like, you know, they're more four quadranty. Like, you know, this is going to appeal to the kids and the adults, right? So they don't get too crazy with it. And then there's always something going on when they're doing it, right? There's a character walking around, you know, there's little bursts of action to break up the stuff and then slow down. So I feel like this is a much more streamlined Matrix movie than the two sequels. And for that, I'm very happy.
And yet it's the longest sequel.
It is. But I feel like the Matrix trilogy, the first Matrix kind of was, you know, this weird out of nowhere sort of revolutionary movie. the second and third Matrix ones, Reloaded and Revolutions, were kind of just, like you said, Mike, up their own ass with all these philosophical discussions. And it kind of just lost its way. They got bogged down with all that plot and all that world building. And a lot of it just didn't work. I find them both fun to watch, but there are moments where I even check out. This one, though, felt like, you know, let's get back to the fun of it. Let's just focus on this love story. We'll mention some philosophical stuff, but we're not going to, like, you know, go over your head or make you question reality all that much, or, you know, have all this introspection. We're just going to get to the love story, right? Because that's kind of the driving force of this movie. And I really enjoyed that. The action, I don't want to repeat what you guys just said, but yeah, it's a little lacking. I think Rodrigo hit the nail on the head. I think the kung fu aspects of this movie are severely lacking versus the other ones. And that can come down to the fight choreography just not being where it was. Could also come down to the fact that, you know, Keanu Reeves is 20 years older, despite what he looks like. And he can't move like a 30-year-old anymore. We won't get into spoilers with that last act, but I think that last act really saves it for me. I'm super high on this movie. I wouldn't give it, like, you know, it's not up there with The Matrix itself, but I would say of the sequels, it's definitely the best in my eyes. You know, strong B for me. Do you guys agree?
Yeah, I might even give it a higher grade for me.
Yeah. But not Matrix level, but definitely best of the sequels.
Yeah, the original is obviously, there's a reason it's still amazing, you know, upon rewatching. And yeah, I don't think anything you make could touch it. I mean, they would have had to really, really outdo themselves to make people say it.
Well, I just think that you would never be able to reach those levels of innovation.
Exactly.
It's not even so much innovation, though. Although, you know, when you think about it, like, you know, they comment on it like bullet time, and there's definitely a lot of things that are innovative in that movie. But if you boiled Matrix down to its nuts and bolts, and I rewatched the whole trilogy back in October or November, and the first film is so miles ahead of all of them, but because in a way it's like, it's not meant to even go further in a way. Like, it's a perfectly constructed kind of, like, you know who talks about, not that his word is like the word of God or anything, but, like, you know who talks about this movie a lot all the time is Christopher Nolan. And if you notice, his movies are all kind of set up in the same kind of way, but they just end. They don't turn into franchises, but they're sort of constructed in a similar kind of, like, here's a world. I'm the protagonist that doesn't know anything about this. I'm not unclear to what this is. I dive into it, and then I learn, and then I get this big magical reveal, and then it ends. And then it ends with an awing, right? Mm-hmm. Christopher Nolan always wants to awe you in the end and leave you with, like, your jaw on the floor, and then just end and peace out and never come back. And that's kind of what The Matrix does. I feel like he's been really influenced for that for a reason. Like, it's like, you know, even though his films are different, I feel like a lot of the its basic ideas are something he's ascribed to. The other thing about it is that it's like, it's slightly, it suffers from a similar kind of idea of the horror film. Like, horror films generally, like, sequels are bad because once the reveal is, once the magic trick is, the rabbit is out of the hat, like, it's out of the hat, right? You didn't know what was going on. And then the rabbit or the monster in a horror film comes out and you've seen the monster. It's like, oh, okay, I've seen that thing. So it's not as scary the second time. There's no surprise. And The Matrix has a similar idea in terms of its ideas in the world. And that's like, that, you know, once the rabbit's out of the hat and you understand everything, you know, then it's like, oh, okay, wow, that's amazing. And then it ends. But then this film's continues. So, but it's really sort of set up, like, Nolan does the same thing, sort of like that, the rabbit out of the hat. And then it's, oh, wow, now I can understand where this is all going. And so it's like, you know, the joy of The Matrix, or if you watch that film in the first one closely, it's really about this guy who doesn't understand what's going on. He's, you know, the rabbit going, or Alice going down the, you know, Alice in Wonderland, and, you know, Alice doesn't know what's going on, and then she eventually figures it out, and then it's over. So, like, the whole joy of that film is Keanu's character sort of, like, trying to figure out the world, and then it ends, you know, with this great thing. He becomes this superhero, and then it ends. And I honestly still believe to this day, it's like that ending is so perfect.
Yeah, it really is.
Should have just ended right there, and you would have just been left with awe and wonder forever. And all the continuing films, what they do is they rob it of mystery. Like, that's what we do in our continued, ongoing, forever never ending storytelling, as we rob things of mystery. And the Matrix was had so much, even when it was sort of solved by the end, you know, quote unquote solved, it still had just layers and layers of mystery to it again, which is a thing that Nolan holds on to. You sort of like, you get what happens, but it feels enigmatic and mysterious, and the subsequent sequels just kind of like rob it of all its mystery, and that's part of the reason why it's those subsequent sequels aren't that great. Okay, so long rant over, sorry. The fourth film, Matrix Resurrections, basically tries to reboot itself without spoiling anything, and tries to get you back into that same mode of like, but the problem is the viewer already knows, but it tries to put the protagonists back in the same spot of not knowing. And that's the sweet spot of the Matrix, of not knowing and then going into the Matrix, diving into it, plugging in and learning about it. So they reattempt to do that, but again, the audience has already been through that ride, so it's not as the surprise, the thrill, the element of all that, it's that's missing, and it'll always be fundamentally missing because it's built like that. It's not like Star Wars, where or any other franchise, it's not built on going down the rabbit hole mystery and figuring this thing out. Most franchises are just adventure stories and they go on. The Matrix is sort of different. So I guess my long-winded argument is that, like, it'll never be as good as that first film, because that first film is just, and not because that first film is amazing, but because it's constructed in a certain way that, like, it's just not really meant to go on, you know?
I think what you're describing is, like, he's this guy who desperately wants out of his, like, office box, and he wants someone to come and kind of whisk him away and have that Alice in Wonderland experience. But this movie, they kind of play with that. So they kind of, like you said, try to have their cake and eat it too, in that he is experiencing that all over again, but at the same time, they flip it on its head. They have this commentary about people and how we've kind of deluded ourselves, and we don't want out of this fantasy that we've built up around ourselves. So I think it kind of presents a really interesting kind of stance on what you saw the first time around. And I know some people probably roll their eyes and are like, oh yeah, real great philosophical talk there. But I thought it was, at least you can't do it again, but you could reframe it in an interesting way. And I think they did that, at least for me.
Yeah. So let's pause for a second. Let's talk about this now in a spoilery way so that we can really get into that, because I think that's an interesting thing.
Before we do that, I do want to tell people, if you can rewatch them, rewatch the trilogy, because this is, it's really, it's one of the movies that kind of requires it.
Sadly, there are a lot of callbacks to even minor moments. So definitely rewatch. Okay, so we're going to pause. We'll come back with spoiler discussion.
They taught you good. Made you believe their world was all you deserved. But some part of you knew that was a lie. Some part of you remembered what was real.
Okay, so gentlemen, let's get right to it. We were talking beforehand about the setup of this movie and how it kind of mirrors the first Matrix. And just to catch everybody up to speed, we find out in Resurrections that Neo is hooked back up to the Matrix. He's hooked up opposite Trinity, but they've both been rebooted, so to speak. He's now a game designer who turned his Matrix visions into a video game franchise. Trinity's now Tiffany, a married mom living with Chad Stahelski.
I would pause you for a second there, if I can.
Sure.
Because I think you're not quite getting it.
Okay, go for it. Go for it.
Like, I'll let you go back on it, but it's not that he's turned the Matrix. It's like, it's always been that. In this world, the Matrix never existed. It was always just a game.
Right, but he's been rebooted as a video game designer and he still has these Matrix memories. He doesn't know their memories. He sees them as visions.
Right, but he basically has no recollection of it. To say that he's been, like, they're basically wiped slate's clean. They're back to where they were in the beginning.
Right.
And the Matrix, essentially, fundamentally to him and this world, has never existed, and all it was a video game the entire time.
That he designed, that he basically retold the story of the Matrix trilogy as a video game franchise. So in the movie,
no, not just to be clear, he didn't go through the Matrix experience and then said, I'm going to make a game of it. It never existed. It was just in this version, it's basically saying, which is, it's just important because it's fundamental for a lot of people. Like even when you hear it, it does sound really dumb. It's like in this version of the Matrix never existed. All it is a video game in the mind created by Mr. Anderson,
Thomas Anderson. Yeah. What I'm saying though is that the basic premise is, imagine you woke up and you had this story idea for this video game called The Matrix. You make it into a trilogy because it's such a vivid thought in your head. That's what he did. And he couldn't shake these thoughts of, they weren't memories. They were just this idea he had for The Matrix and these characters.
Right. And it becomes meta because it becomes a huge hit. It revolutionizes video games. It becomes like one of the most heralded video game trilogies of all time.
And it even has people pontificating about what it means.
Right. Yes. And so it totally mirrors the experience of the films through this game. And this is what he's created, this game. And then it gets super meta in the way that it's like, okay, this has been a super hit. And then all of a sudden the higher ups want a new video game.
Yeah.
Just
Warner Brothers. They were going to make it without you regardless.
Yeah.
Right. Well, which is like, I think is the key to the entire movie.
Yeah.
That line.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Jonathan Groff, who is
Smith,
is the new Smith, essentially.
Well, that's his character's name.
Right. Smith. So he's the CEO or whatever of the video game company. And he comes to Thomas Anderson and calls him to his office. Hey, we got to meet. And it's like, hey, you know, it's been however long, it's been a decade or something, probably the same amount of time as the last Matrix film. And he says, like, you know, the higher ups say they really want a sequel. Warner Brothers wants a sequel, and they're going to make it with or without you. So are you in or you out? Essentially, that's his proposition. And that to me is like, is almost verbatim what they told Lily and Lana way back when, probably about 4 or 5 years ago.
And the Zach Penn script? The Zach Penn script?
Yeah, you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, when Michael B. Jordan was going to be cast and all that.
Right, right, right. So like that is to me, and one day that'll come out, that's verbatim. And that's her way of like playing with like this strange fuck you. Again, I guess maybe it does apply, this fuck you, but I'm also going to do it at the same time. This cake, you have your cake and eat it too. And so it's like, they said, we're going to make it with or without you. And I, as you guys just mentioned, certain people had been rumored to write drafts over the years. And I think Lily and Lana both were faced with like, all right, if we don't do this, they are going to make it. And they have written a script and there is all this stuff. And then, you know, Lily says, well, you know, fuck that, I'm out, I don't care, they can go and make it without them. And Lana clearly has to have a spiritual and existential crisis about making the entire thing and whether she should or not. And then she turns that spiritual and existential crisis about selling herself out and whether she should do this or not into a movie.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that, see, and you're explaining it, and that just sells me more on this idea. I think the meta-ness of this movie really works overall, I should say. There are moments where it's a bit much, like the montage of Thomas Anderson struggling with his own mental stability, and then montage that with, you know, these assholes in a boardroom trying to talk about what the Matrix should be 20 years later.
God, those scenes are so painful.
It's a bit rough, but the idea being that
really painful.
But it's painful because it's true. Like, you can see that this is, it's not only a commentary on all the people online talking about every which way they see.
It's a commentary about being in those boardrooms with Warner Brothers and how much contempt she has for, it's almost, she's like, she's got complete contempt for everybody at Warner Brothers and all the studio peoples, and then made a film regardless, in spite of all that, in spite of knowing that she shouldn't, in spite of knowing she has contempt for all of them, in spite of knowing that this is a fucking soulless, like, cash grab effort. But and then to that end, I will admit she has in going through this sort of crazy exercise, she does create something at least somewhat interesting in terms of its, like I think Mike said earlier, it's funnier. So it has like some of the, I don't think the meta stuff is very great, but when it gets really silly to the way, to the level that it's kind of fun and humorous, that's when it's good. The love stuff is good and the action is good, but it's a hard road of getting there. It's pretty messy.
I feel like this is a very interesting setup though, right? Like I feel that you're absolutely right. It's not a secret that Warner Brothers has been trying to get the Matrix rebooted in some capacity for the better part of 15 years to a decade, right? Yeah. And they were going to do it with or without the Wachowskis. And I think what's interesting is Lana Wachowski has said this numerous times, that she had this idea of a love story with Trinity and Neo based on, you know, the fallout of her parents dying, and they died not at the same time, but within relative close proximity of each other. And because of that, she had this idea of this like epic love story. And, you know, it's interesting that then she was like, well, do I want to go back to the Matrix to tell this story? Right. And Lily was like, no, but you know, you do you. And because of that, I think Lana was like, well, I can't make this movie without commentating on the reason why I don't want to make this movie, but I'm feeling compelled to. And I think that's an incredibly interesting thing that's probably going to get lost on 99% of the people watching it who don't know all the behind the scenes stuff.
No, but you can't help but know, like it's so meta.
It's pretty blatant.
It's blatant, but you don't know the impetus for it.
Even if you don't know the impetus of it, you can feel the war inside of it in the way that it's like the whole meta fighting itself, right? Like the commentary about itself and the commentary about sequels, you know, like I think regardless if you don't know a lick of that, that's impossible to not notice.
Yeah. And I think it's also interesting. Those cringy montage scenes, they're fun in the juxtaposition with what Neo is going through. But also I think it's also Lana Wachowski just admitting that she's sick of hearing everybody tell her what the Matrix is about, which
I really liked that. Yeah.
I thought that was super clever because you hear people talk about the Matrix and they say things so definitively, you know, oh, it's definitely a trans allegory. You know, oh, it's definitely a commentary on blah, 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 you know, and in this movie, she's basically saying like, it's whatever you want it to be. It doesn't matter. What matters is this love story. And I applaud her for that.
I kind of agree with a lot of that stuff. But the other thing I think is really interesting is that what my take is, I think a lot of people can be on board with and totally agree. It's just that results will vary. But I think like if you get that spiel about how it's built and how it came about and, you know, all this stuff, I think most people can get on board on that. But some people go like, yeah, I like it regardless. And other people might be like, you know, it loses me because of those things. But I think its intentions and where it's coming from, this whole, you know, Warner Brothers, like sort of like, to me, it's a movie born out of a gun to your head. That's the starting point of this film. It's like that scene from Seven where, you know, the rain's coming down on the head of Brad Pitt's character and the gun's at his head. And, you know, it's a slow dramatic moment of whether he's going to pull the trigger or not, you know? And that's to me is like how this film was born, but it's Warner Brothers and the Wachowskis.
Yeah. I see it more as almost like where I think people are going to either love or hate this movie is your feeling on whether or not a piece of art can simultaneously be entertaining and also be commentating on why it shouldn't exist, right? Like that's a very weird place to be, but this is a movie that actively jokes about reboots and sequels and how they're unnecessary and harmful, but then tries to be a reboot and a sequel because Lana Wachowski had this idea that she wanted to see through. And it's like almost like a gun to her head, but I think the Wachowskis almost would have been perfectly okay with somebody else taking over and then just, you know, almost like a Stan Lee sort of thing, like, you know, signs the characters created by the Wachowskis and go have your fun, you know. But she felt so compelled that she had to come back and really make this movie that is just like almost painful in the meta sense, where she's like, you know, has to live through this shit just to tell her love story.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it, because it's like the love story, when it gets to it, like later, deeper into the movie, and then when it starts to blossom, is like the good stuff, right?
Yeah.
But it's like she has to not only wrestle with the why I shouldn't do this, she puts it on screen rather than like get that baggage out of the way and do that on your own time, you know, not on my time, but she brings that into the movie. And there's this whole like angst and blah, 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 like for like a good, you know, hour or something before it almost starts, it has to argue with itself for an hour while it, why it should even exist.
Yeah. There's also a lot of self-hatred in the movie. I'm not saying Lana Wachowski is self-hating, but you literally have the character of the Merovingian in an entire fight scene yelling about how terrible reboots and sequels are in almost like he looks like a madman. And he's yelling in such almost an incoherent way. You just hear these like buzzwords like reboot, sequels, legacy. And you're just like, oh, my God, we're trying to have a fight here and you just can't escape it.
Yes.
How they ruined his life, all that kind of stuff.
That scene is like brilliant and horrible at the same time. It is like,
I love it.
So painfully annoying and yet kind of funny and brilliant. But it's like it sort of sums up the entire movie. And I think it sums up how people will feel about it. And I think you tee it up well, Charles. And it's like, we're trying to have an action movie here. And then a bunch of old characters show up and start screaming about why the movie shouldn't exist and why it's selling itself out while it's taking place. It's like ridiculous.
Yeah, I kind of love the bonkers elements of it though, where you got annoyed. I was like, this is so great. I love that.
And I think this is like the definition of a your mileage may vary sort of movie.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
As in terms of mileage will vary, I believe not that it should be the be all and end all of anything, but I believe it's like at 65 or something like that on Rotten Tomatoes.
It's bound to be a divisive movie.
Which it totally fits, right? Like Rotten Tomatoes typically is, you know, it's a binary aggregator. So it's either really good or really bad, right? There's no in between. Yeah. But if you look at a Rotten Tomatoes score as a you know, barometer for a movie, this is definitely a 65 type of movie, right?
It's like actually
the parts that work really work.
Yeah, it's actually back up to 70 on Rotten Tomatoes. And then always as a smart thing to do, if you take those things seriously, it's worth looking at Metacritic, which is more nuanced and more accurate, to be frank. And on Metacritic, it's at 64.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about the new elements of this movie, because we talked about the meta stuff, but the new elements are super interesting because you have, on the one hand, you have characters like Jonathan Groff as the new Smith. You have Yahya Abdul-Mateen II as Morpheus, which quite literally a reboot. And then you have Jessica Henwick as a new character, Bugs, which I cringe at her name, but she's really kind of fun in the movie. And then you have Neil Patrick Harris as the Analyst. So you have these two characters playing reboots and two characters playing new characters. Did any of these folks like stand out in a good way or bad way to you guys?
I thought all of them were really great in their own way. I mean, Jonathan Groff, I'm really glad that he only did his Smith impression in that first introductory scene and with purpose.
Yeah.
The rest of it, he very much made it his own.
A much more fashionable Smith.
Fashionable, charismatic as hell. And same with Yahya. Like he was not, he like partially was doing a Morpheus impression, but that was part of the character, you know?
Yeah.
That was, he was an amalgamation of Neo's version of Morpheus and Morpheus and you know, I thought it was a really interesting way to kind of reframe the character. And then Bugs, obviously, she was just a fan of everyone, you know.
I put in my notes that she was leader of the fanboys.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the weakest scene, I think, is the introduction of the crew. And they have a quote unquote neo-ologist. I was like, oh, God. But anyway. Yeah.
But it makes sense within the world, you know,
I
the
suppose.
Figure that he is.
Yeah. And then Neil Patrick Harris as the Analyst, the kind of fun cousin of the Architect.
Exactly. I was going to say he's the Architect, but like more egomaniacal.
And silly.
Yeah, and silly.
Not above cracking a joke about bullet time. Which is so weird. Rodrigo, did anybody kind of drop the ball or hit it out of the park for you?
Not really. I think Henwick is kind of interesting, although her character, like the Bugs thing and the tattoos, kind of dumb. But she's clearly she's the highlight, even though she's not much of a highlight. I think she's destined for bigger and better things, for sure. And we still haven't really gotten a chance to see her, because, you know, I mean, she's been in that.
You didn't love Iron Fist?
Yeah, she's like Iron Fist. She's been shortchanged a lot. I feel like she's even shortchanged in this, but she's clearly got a lot of charisma and presence and potential. So I'd like to, I would really love to see her in something like genuinely good. And Neil Patrick Harris is sort of the same. He's kind of like, it's kind of the way I sort of feel about the film. He's kind of awful, but he's kind of deliciously fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, yeah, I think that maybe even Groff is a little bit like that. He's kind of really fucking terrible, but it's kind of fun because they're just so like evil villain chewing the scenery and twirling their mustaches about. Like, I mean, Neil Patrick Harris is just so over the top and so ridiculous. It's like, it's like, you know, he should be, you know, having twirling his mustache and petting a rabbit or something, you know. Like, it's so,
wouldn't have surprised me if that was in a scene.
it was so silly, but you know, sometimes silly is a little bit enjoyable here and there.
Mm-hmm.
Depends. I think as it went on, I started just being like, all right, whatever, be silly, fine, like be dumb, whatever, let's just enjoy this like for what it is. And you know, that last act is fun. So
I gotta mention, we mentioned a couple times, but Yahya Abdul-Mateen II is having so much fun as Morpheus. Mm-hmm. It's almost as if he thinks he's getting away with something. like he's winking at the audience, like, can you believe they're letting me fucking do this? You know, like everything about him is just slightly dialed up from what Lawrence Fishburne did in a really fun way. Yeah. And I'm all about it. I think he's a great actor. I think he's got a lot of presence, and his version of Morpheus is a lot of fun. So, agreed. Yeah.
I defy you to tell me what Christina Ricci's purpose was.
Oh, just to be there.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. What does she do? She's in it for like 2 seconds.
She's in the boardroom.
Exactly. I was like, what's going on here?
I mean, she was in Speed Racer. So
yeah. Right. I would have loved for her to have a point.
I guess the other thing about, you know, just to tie back to something that you had said, I think, Charles, about like with Lana without Lily and all this stuff, and maybe it's too silly or having too much fun without her and stuff. It was like, I might disagree, because I think everything post Matrix is very silly. Like Speed Racer is very silly. Cloud Atlas is very silly. Jupiter Ascending is ridiculous and stupid. So like they've actually in the aggregate, I think they probably have more silly and ridiculous than they do like the solemn of the Matrix. And the Matrix is maybe the sweet spot of like the impossible and the ridiculous, with maybe something a little bit more thoughtful and you know, philosophical, whereas, you know, I don't think any of those films have that except for Cloud Atlas, and anything came up afterwards. You know, Jupiter Ascending is pretty asinine in my estimation, and Speed Racer is just, you know, a visual fun silly thing. But
yeah, Speed Racer is the anomaly for me. I never got it.
I thought it was fun. It was,
I know that some people really like it, but it's just, it's As a follow-up to the Matrix movies, it just felt like really out there and not.
Right, but that's what I'm saying, is like, to me, it's like this is more in line with everything that they've done after the Matrix.
Mm-hmm. I suppose. Like, I think
even if Lily's not around.
I think the Cloud Atlas and Jupiter Ascending were them really trying like sincerely to make like thoughtful movies. I think Jupiter Ascending is very melodramatic and space opery, but they're trying to create their own Star Wars in that movie. So you kind of just sort of like, you know, whatever. What I'm saying about this one, though, as far as the humor and the silliness, is I think whereas the jokes in the original Matrix movies were like Keanu Reeves' delivery of some like, whoa, you know, mm-hmm. where it's almost like this, you know, if it wasn't Keanu Reeves saying it, it wouldn't have been funny. This actually has like Marvel style quips almost, where it's jarring at first a little bit to laugh openly at a Matrix movie. It feels weird. So.
Yeah, I
agree. It's definitely obviously hyper self-aware and has some fun with that, and there's definitely it's definitely more fun and funny in a way that the Matrix movies in the past definitely were. So at least there's, it's got that going for it.
Yeah. So I want to talk, we talked about the last act, and I think that this really is the heart and soul of this movie, because it does give you the love story finally between Neo and Trinity, but it also gives you what is the most interesting action scene, I would say, which I think is after the big brawl in the bar or the cafe, but that the idea that they can now make a horde of, you know, crazed people like zombies, and having them drive that motorcycle, which is one of Keanu Reeves' own arch motorcycles, by the way. But having people literally throw themselves out of buildings to act as like human missiles is really interesting. And I really enjoyed that that chase scene. And to me, that's the only scene in the movie, because the kung fu was a little sedated, that I felt like could rival the best of the original trilogy.
Yeah, that action sequence is fucking terrific.
Yeah, it is a little heavy on the Keanu does his Matrix hands and things go boom, but I still enjoyed it. I still had a lot of fun.
Yeah, they don't let him fly until the very end, which is a bummer. So what do? They give him the Force. Which is kind of such a generic kind of one note ability that it's a little, I don't know. I was kind of lost by that. Like, why of all the things you could do you just make him have the Force? But, you know.
Yeah, I think that's why the action kind of underwhelmed me, is that was a lot of his moves.
Yeah, that's the only thing he had, right? And it was just basically a, if you think of that action sequence as fun as it is, it's kind of, it's got one big cheat, which is basically Keanu blocking anything that's going to be of you know, danger. And he just keeps doing that over and over and over and over again, and getting them out of trouble. So there's not much to it in that way, but I got to say, it's really enjoyable. It's really fun. I mean, it's just basically trying to get them to that crescendo of like jumping off the roof, I guess.
Yeah.
Spoiler, they jump off a roof.
They've said it in pretty much every interview. So I'm
well, not sure. Just that, it's in the trailer. I was rewatching the trailer, and there's the scene of the two of them jumping off. They just cut it right before the big reveal, which is,
and apparently they actually really did that and really did it like many times. I'm like,
they flew.
No, they jumped off the building on wires.
Oh,
that seems insane that they actually did it.
I mean, we're in a world where Tom Cruise does it for a living.
That's Tom Cruise. Like,
yeah, but the Wachowskis were pretty, for being known as these pioneers of like special effects, they did a lot of practical shit.
Oh, I mean, they literally had to teach the cast of the Matrix how to do fake kung fu, because they wanted to do as much, you know, with the original actors as they could. So,
yeah,
but yeah, final act, really good. But it, as we tease, they jump off the building and it's revealed that Trinity's kind of the hero of this movie, right? She can finally fly. And then we see kind of this climax of the, well, not climax, but the end of the movie, the ribbon on the package is this scene with Trinity, Neo, and the analyst, Neil Patrick Harris, where it's clear that now Trinity has the ability, and presumably Neo, to rewrite the Matrix on the fly. Which is very interesting. And it seems as if they're going to create their own kind of utopia now. What do you think of this ending? And is this now the definitive ending of the franchise, or is this just setting up another sequel?
I mean, all good sequels ultimately end in a way that could be either way. And this one is very much that. The Warner Brothers could easily make a couple more to spark off of this. And I'm sure they might, if, you know, the streaming numbers are okay. God knows the box office isn't going to be great. But yeah, I think it could go either way easily.
Did you like the ending?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Rodrigo, what'd you think?
It was fine. Whatever. It's kind of more gumbo mumbo jumbo of I can rewrite this code or whatever. And I was like,
she literally punches the jaw off Neil Patrick Harris.
Yeah, that was fun.
It's fine. It's whatever. I at this point, like, they could easily set up more sequels. The problem, though, is that, and the problem that one of the reasons that it took so long for this to happen, and why there was other scripts written and all that other stuff, is that they need Keanu and they need Carrie Ann Moss, and they won't come back if one of the Wachowskis is not involved. And so that's really what was the thing that got Warner Brothers, when she said she was going to do more, like, can she get them? And of course she can, you know, and that makes it, you know, that's why it's also like another legacy kind of sequel, right? It's like, that's all that's been happening lately, is like all these like nostalgia, flashback, whatever, inverted pat on the back, kind of whatever this is trying to do. And but they're in that kind of weird pickle that I'm sure like Lana could almost leave them in this place and be like, okay, well, I left you in a place that you could restart and do whatever you want. You can have it now, but they'll need Keanu and Carrie Ann Moss for that. And they don't seem to be at all interested in it without one of them. So I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, right? So the ending I enjoy just as the ending of this movie. I also think it's a pretty great ending to the franchise, and I kind of, you know, naively think that they should just end it that way. But I think what Lana did is she simultaneously set it up to potentially have more stories while also making it so that you really can't tell another story. You now have two characters who are incredibly overpowered, right? Who can literally rewrite the fabric of reality as, you know, a snap of a finger. And where do you go with that? Nobody wants to see that movie.
Yeah, it should be over, right?
Like, yeah.
It should be like, they won, essentially. They have all the power. They've won. The good guys win the end. And that's how, like, a lot of these, that's storytelling. That's how, you know, these things, that's how the first Matrix should have ended, you know?
Yeah.
But unfortunately, the nature of capitalism is that it will continue in some form or another. But
they'll have to reboot it, is what I'm saying, right? Like, that's
not necessarily. Just like with the other ones, there's still the war, only the lines are being blurred a little bit. You know, the veil is being lifted. So they still could easily make, you know, the machine war and the humans and, you know, the Matrix within that, obviously.
No, what I mean though is they have to literally reboot the Matrix. Like, they have to do another version of the Matrix.
Well, that's been done many times within the Matrix series itself.
Right. So that's what I'm saying, is that the way to do it, I think, if you want to, is because you're right, Rodrigo, they're not going to do it without Lana Wachowski. And I think if Lana Wachowski returned for a fifth one, that's kind of like undermines every bit of commentary of this movie. Yeah. So she really can't, or shouldn't, I should say. And then you're just left with, okay, we got to call up Michael B. Jordan and see if he really wants to do it. You know, like that's kind of where I think you're at with this. And then at that point, it's like, what are we doing? Like, come on.
What if you told other stories within the world of the Matrix? I mean, it would essentially be.
Yeah, the same. I think that's inevitable.
I think it ends up being the same kind of story, because if you get a new character that they're trying to, doesn't necessarily have to be the chosen one, but like, what else can you do? It's like, you can tell further stories. So it would probably have to be someone that you unplug from, you know, the Matrix into the real world, which is, you know, the Zion and all that stuff. So, but then I guess that would be in a way, maybe a soft reboot, because you're telling a similar story, but you're obviously doing it with new actors but that still on a script level, like, how is that different? Like, that it's a really tough road, you know?
It's interesting, because I as we're talking about it, I can't shake the feeling that they're in a Terminator situation, right? Mm-hmm. Like, Terminator 2 was such a perfect ending to the franchise, and they tried to just reboot it, didn't work. Then they're like, all right, fine, we'll do Salvation. We'll just talk about the war, you know? That didn't work.
They tried every angle, and they explored everything, and I mean, that franchise is dead. It's a good analogy, because it is the rare franchise that works, even though, you know, it does have similar horror elements, where like the guy's out of the, you know, the surprise and all that is over. He's out, you know, in a way. But it's the sequel that's just terrific, you know. And of course, James Cameron has always been the one to do it. He's done it twice now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I just feel like any which way the story goes now is just either a retread or a story I'm not interested in seeing, or just completely silly and over the top. Like, there, I don't want to see the war with Zion. We got the good Zion war, or now it's IO, but we got the good human versus machine war and revolutions. I don't need to see the creation of the Matrix. We don't need to get rid of all the mystique, you know, like, let's keep some of it. And I definitely don't want to see another Chosen One story. Like, come on. Yeah.
You don't want to see machines and humans realize that they can work together and figure out the blotting of the sun and kumbaya. You know, you don't want to see that.
No,
But that sounds terrible. Like, that would be something they'd do.
You look at all the other options and then you kind of realize the only way forward is to keep going with Keanu and Carrie Ann Moss and where this is going. Right. Even though it is, like you said, like, God, how do you write this? They're the most all powerful beings now, but like, it almost feels like that's the only way forward. And yet nobody's going to do that because no one's probably going to go on for more.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, they're both approaching an age where, you know, as much as we all love Keanu Reeves, like, you can't do this sort of Kung Fu stuff anymore as well. And yeah, I don't need to see it anymore. Like, I feel the same with the Spider-Man movie, right? Like, I'm happy where they left that movie, but it could also be the end and I'd be perfectly fine. You know, I'm almost just desperate to just call up Warner Brothers and say, just don't
leave money on the table, please.
I know.
Well, the thing is, if this, you know, it doesn't have a huge Rotten Tomatoes score, Metacritic score, whatever, critics were mixed on it, Omicron is really spiking right now. There are projections already saying this is going to get its ass kicked once again by Spider-Man No Way Home, and it just doesn't have the same appeal anymore, and it's going to be on HBO Max so everybody can watch it at home. Maybe even if everybody wants to go forward, there's not going to be another one.
That's true. I mean, and honestly, it's also a big ask from people. Like, we're not even kidding. If you haven't seen the movie, you got to really see Revolutions and Reloaded. And that's a big ask for some people, because either they watched them in 2003 when they came out and were like, oh, that don't need to watch that again. Or they just never watch it and just have the ending with Keanu flying up to the camera from the Matrix in their head.
Then they're thoroughly confused by this.
Yeah, because this movie literally has callbacks all the time, like scenes from the Matrix and the sequels all the time. So, yeah, I just, you know, I don't see it having big box office legs. That's for sure. HBO Max movies, they'll of course say it was the biggest thing since sliced bread. You know, but they won't give us any sort of stats. And, you know, maybe we'll get an HBO Max prequel series or some shit, but that's
no more prequel series.
God damn. Before the Matrix was created, the creator of the Matrix.
It'll take place in like 2050 and it'll be about the start of the machine war. It'll be about like an Elon Musk, you know, creating the first like highly advanced AI. And yeah.
It was about the app that turned everything into the Matrix.
Wait, that sounds like something else. Oh, yeah, Genesis. Okay.
Hey, I'm glad Dark Fate exists, guys.
I am too. As a legacy whore sometimes. I do like my occasional nostalgia. But yeah, so any last thoughts on the Matrix before we wrap this up? Because I think basically what we've said is that it's very meta. Some of the action's great. Kind of funny, but also didn't need it.
Oh, didn't need it. Come on.
I don't think we needed it.
I'm very happy we got it. Well, I'll just say that.
Okay. Rodrigo, any last thoughts?
It could be seen as, I don't know, maybe some people would see it as redemption for the Revolutions and Reloaded.
Yeah, I'm interested to hear what people say who like hated the sequels, what they say about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think upon rewatch Revolutions in particular, because I did rewatch that the night before we saw this, I think that actually holds up quite well. Reloaded still has its issues, but that damn architect scene, oh my God.
Which is the last one?
Revolutions is the last one.
Oh, I think the last one is definitely the weakest.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I like the Zion stuff upon rewatch. the war.
Well, the thing is, you watch those other two, they're perfectly fine and
oh yeah,
perfectly watchable things for sure. It's just they so pale because they don't have any of that mystery and the awe and the wonder of the first one. You know, all that's gone, and it's that same evaporation is the same again. I hate to keep using that analogy, but it's sort of it's the same kind of thing that happens with like horror movies when horror movies don't have that special je ne sais quoi, special sauce of the mystery of what is this horrific thing, right? We know it's something that's in the shadows, it's been in the water, but then it's out. And, you know, yes, there are some popular horror sequels, but I probably in the aggregate, this is maybe like 90% versus a good 10%, right? It's like, it's hard to get past that missing special sort of mysterious ingredient that's even hard to explain. But The Matrix definitely has that, right?
Yeah, I agree. I think that's what I kind of meant by we don't need this. As much as I enjoyed this movie, and I did thoroughly enjoy it, I really didn't need another sequel to this. I would perfectly have been happy with just watching The Matrix, the original movie, and kind of forgetting about the sequels. But you know, now this movie kind of required me to watch the other ones again. But you know, even with my nostalgic brain, as much as I love this stuff, I almost, especially in discussing it with you guys, I almost feel bad it was made. Like, I almost want to write a letter to Lana Wachowski and be like, I'm sorry they made you do this just to tell your love story.
Oh God, I would pay so much money to talk to her. You have five questions with her.
Yeah.
And 5 minutes. I'd be like, absolutely, yes. I would kill to talk to her. I also want to throw it out there that like, if any of us get a chance to interview Zach Penn, we definitely have to that just so we can ask about this. And the same thing with if any of us ever talk to Michael B. Jordan again, get his, you know, take. I probably was much other than like, yeah, they approached me and I was interested in it. And maybe if it was a good script, I'd go, but it's probably not anything more than that. But I would love to, you know, people have kind of forgotten that story, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Michael B. Jordan has never found a franchise he hasn't said yes to. So he was probably like, Matrix. Sure. Yeah. Cool. They're like, we haven't even told you what it's about. Doesn't matter. But yeah. Okay. So we're going to wrap this up. Thank you, Rodrigo. Thank you, Mike, for shooting the shit again, talking about Matrix. Everybody, Matrix comes out on HBO Max. You should see it in theaters, but don't do it if it's not safe. Just watch it on HBO Max because Keanu gave you your thumbs up. You're allowed to. So go right ahead. But yeah, thank you guys.